There's a buzz in the air in New York City today. Go Yankees! What an epic win last night. Good for them. Man, I want to find out what they're drinking and see if we can take that same cocktail over to Giant Stadium. Whew. All right, I don't want to bring down the buzz. The show is Inside. My name is Mark Farrell. Welcome to Thursday. How are you feeling out there? It's a great day in New York City. Fall is actually, it's actually starting to feel like September in October, which is, I guess, a good thing that we're kind of leading towards the autumn weather and season. Yeah, we got a lot to talk about today. You're going to meet an incredible author, Tom Corley. He knows everything about green, money, how to invest it, how to save it. He studied the rich. He studied the poor. And he's going to tell us what revelations he's made. But until we get to that point, I got to vent about something. So the Boy Scouts of America pretty much have joined forces with the Girl Scouts of America. Because as of yesterday, the Boy Scouts will allow girls to participate and earn their Eagle badge. And where do we draw the line? I'm sorry, I'm all about opportunity. I'm all about ERA, giving people and being of modern thought. But where do we draw the goddamn line? This is ridiculous. They have their own entity. It's called the Girl Scouts of America. So then, I think there's actually been something in the past where boys are trying to become Girl Scouts. I mean, so why don't they just meld, become one? You know Trump is going to be tweeting about this. Because his son, I forget his son's name, who, it's got an odd name. Anyway, but it's an odd idea, a concept. Yes, there should be maybe private clubs that no longer should allow women and vice versa. Obviously, you remember the pro golf issue that happened about 5-7 years ago with African-American players. They were going to have the PGA there. I have no idea what I'm talking about in terms of golf. So I'm kind of making up the actual PGA stuff. But it was a real issue in terms of a lot of African-American players did not want to go there because this particular club didn't allow African-American members. So things of that nature make total sense to me. But what does not make sense to me is when you have a known entity like the Boy Scouts of America. It's in their name. It's in their title. The Girl Scouts of America. Brownies. Cub Scouts. I mean, that is what they're devised for. I'm all for having bathrooms, LGBTQ, XYZ. Just making stuff up. In terms of, gender-neutral bathrooms, et cetera, that's fine. But when you have an organization just like that, Boy Scouts, a simple organization, and Girl Scouts, there's no reason why you can't have a boys or girls club only. Yes, they can cross-pollinate, maybe have different activities, or the Boy Scouts can have different events and parties where members of the public, including girls, because they don't have cooties anymore. I guess that's what this is probably all about. They realize, the Boy Scouts of America realize, that girls really don't have cooties. But I just think that it's just getting really out of control. Every day it's just something really wild and ludicrous. And let me know how you feel about this. 1-800-874-8888. 1-800-874-8888. So, how's your pocketbook? How's your future looking? Have you read any good books on financial means lately? Well, chances are you've heard of Tom Corley. He's an author, speaker, CPA, CFP. He's my BFF. You got a lot of initials, man. And president of a top New Jersey financial firm. But more importantly, he's written a book that's turned heads internationally. Rich Habits, The Daily Success Habits of Wealthy Individuals. First edition went on to become an Amazon bestseller in the U.S. 40 times over a three-year period. And he's here today to shed some light, my friend, because you interviewed over a five-year period poor people and rich people. But I guess I'm happy to say, on one regard, I wasn't interviewed, so I'm not considered poor. But on the other regard, I'd like to be a little bit wealthier, and so many other listeners out there in the Progressive Radio Network land would love to also be more well off. What are some key successful points, and why did you set out to find out the disparity between these two?
First of all, thanks for having me on, Mark. I appreciate it. I've done so many of these radio interviews around the world, you know, in Canada, Australia, believe it or not.
Canada part of the United States?
Not.
That's what Trump says.
Ontario is the 51st state, isn't it? That's what we used to call it when I worked for a Canadian
company. Puerto Rico is not part of the states anymore, so we have a vacancy.
But I appreciate being on. And like I said, I've been doing this for, I guess, going back to 2010. I've been trying to get the word out so that I could share these habits so that poor people don't have to stay poor. And it's, you know, if you think about habits, rich habits versus poor habits, everybody focuses on what wealthy people do to become successful, right? It's almost, if you look at all the entirety of the personal development books out there in the literature, it probably 95% is focused. They're focused on wealthy people, successful people.
Now, we're talking about earned money, not born into trust fund people.
Yeah, we're talking about self-made millionaires.
Thank you.
Right. So, but nobody talks about the other side of the coin, which is what not to do, because knowing what to do is only going to get you 50 yards down the field. And so everybody that buys these books and buys into what they're saying, they scratch their heads after a couple of years and say, you know, Mark, I'm no further ahead than I was, you know, 5 years ago. And the reason is because nobody ever shared with them what not to do. So they're continuing to have these bad habits, right? They may have adopted some of these good habits of successful people, but nobody told them what bad habits to avoid. So that was where I was going with this. And why I even pursued this was it has to do with part my business. I had a small business client when I just had taken over the helm of my CPA firm. He came into my office late one night. And he started crying. He was going bankrupt. And he said, you know, I don't know what I'm doing wrong. What are your successful clients doing that I'm not doing? Tell me what I'm doing wrong. And I really worked hard to do some diligence and research. I could only find like the millionaire next door. That was the only thing that really gave me some insight. But they only focused on rich people when they were rich and what they were doing. So I ended up doing a 5-year study on the daily habits, what turned out to be the daily habits of rich people and poor people. I accumulated over 330 data points that said this is what rich people do every single day, and this is what poor people do every single day.
So what was your sample group, and how did you devise? Was it a series of interviews? Was it questions? Was it a combination of both? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I had 144 questions that I asked each individual. There were 233 wealthy individuals. Wealthy is $3.2 million in net investable assets plus $160,000 or more in income. Poor people were less than $5,000 in the bank, basically, and less than $35,000 of income. So that was my criteria.
Single or joint?
Well, a household.
Okay.
Right? So then I would interview these individuals one by one. About 50 to 60% were meetings, and the rest were through emails, telephone calls, and things like that. They thought because this was a blind study, they thought that I was doing helping them with their tax, helping them with credit repair, helping them with financial planning. So that's how I kind of hooked them in. I didn't want anyone to know that I was trying to find out why they were rich or why they were poor. Because to be honest with you, Mark, when they know that, they skew their answers. Anyone who does a survey and knows that they're answering questions about what it takes to be rich, they're going to be disingenuous about and not honest about.
I understand that, because I imagine that they want to, number one, keep it a secret. Or number two, on the flip side, if someone's being perceived as poor or lack of affluence, they're going to be embarrassed.
Right. And so what I wanted is real solid answers, truthful answers. I didn't want the rich people to tell me what they thought I wanted them to hear. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want the poor people, you know, to, I guess, try and use language that made it appear that they were poor for some reason other than their own doing. You know, I was born into a poor family. 41% of the rich people in my study were born into poor families. I had bad parents. Well, there's a lot of bad parents out there. I was subject of divorce. My parents got divorced. Well, it happens all the time. In my rich people group, they had all of those things, but they still became wealthy.
And they can be motivating factors most of the time.
You know what it is in a lot of cases? It's being exposed to someone, either a mentor or parents, who teach you certain specific habits that you
are
take
ingrained,
with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and these habits, they I have Nicholas Christakis, who's has a big study on habits. He found that by the age of 9, the habits that we have at adulthood are forged. So imagine that. Who were you with up until that point? For the most part, you're with your parents, right? So you're adopting or picking up their habits, and then, you know, when you're 40 years old, you're scratching your head and you're saying, "Geez, why aren't I doing better in life?" And nobody ever says, "Well, it's your daily habits." Nobody ever picks that out. So that's what I was focused on. And I actually, when I did the study, I had no idea I was trying to uncover habits. It wasn't until, you know, 4 years into the study, when I started analyzing the data, that the light bulb went off in my head, and I said, "Geez, this is habits. These are little things, habits, daily habits that separate the rich from the poor, and they separate them in a big way because it's like a teeter-totter, you know, a seesaw."
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You have on one side, you have your rich habits, and on the other side, you have your poor habits.
Well, you think on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, it's not a big deal, but cumulatively, over 10, 20, 30, 40 years, obviously, if you're not investing right, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, if you have a riding balance, recurring balance on the credit cards, it takes a toll.
Yeah.
So let's pause for a second because you mentioned the age of 9, and that's an interesting age because that's the age when your family lost their business due to a catastrophic fire.
Yeah, that was something else. My dad, just to lay the groundwork here, my family was very wealthy. I guess in terms of today's dollars, we had about $20 million.
In what industry?
My dad was the main distributor on the East Coast for tools. He had Sears. He had, you think of any big retail outlet that sold
Rickles
tools
back then.
Yeah,
two guys.
There were so many of them.
Sure,
and he was the main guy. And,
really?
And he had a partner. His partner died at the age of 39 suddenly, and my dad was the guy that ran the operations. The salesman, his partner, who was the sales guy, he ran the sales part. And my dad said, "You know, I got to sell the business because I can't do both. I'm an operations guy." Mm-hmm. So he sold the business, and he got about $4.5 million for it, which in today's dollars is a little over $20 million. He got paid in three installments. The first installment he received, the last two installments he didn't receive, and the business reverted back to him after 18 months. However,
that was contractual.
Yeah, well, my dad was a little bit too smart for his own good, so they were a little pissed off. The guys that lost the business, because you'd be pissed off if you just coughed up $1.6 million and you don't have anything to show for it, right? So within 30 days...
Except a toolkit, I imagine, well-stocked.
A lot of tools.
But then doesn't equate.
Within 30 days of my dad taking back the business, which, again, he hadn't been running for 18 months, the warehouse was burned to the ground. And they knew it was arson. They couldn't prove it. So my dad, there was, you know, $3.5 million worth of inventory in the warehouse that was
Poof.
Lost. Anyway, my dad said, "No, you know, no big deal. I've got $3 or $4 million. I'll just start up all over again, and we'll buy the tools." So he started calling his vendors, many of them who had been at, you know, weddings or you know, baptisms, christenings, things like that. They were friends of my dad, and my dad said, "Hey, you know what? This is what happened. I'm going to work it out with the insurance, but meanwhile, can I get some inventory? We're going to start selling. You know, I've got, you know, Sears. You know, I got a $500,000 order."
Sure,
for
he's
Sears.
Got a good rapport with these people,
yeah.
A nice track record.
And they said, "Bill, we still haven't gotten paid on the old inventory."
Oh.
So my dad took back a business that literally had $3.5 million in debt. And my dad had always bought inventory COD, you know, cash on delivery.
So your father thought he was going to be flush.
Yeah, what he should have done at that point is just file for bankruptcy. And I remember having a conversation with him when I was in my mid-40s, and I said, "Dad, why didn't you just fold up the company, keep your $3 million, and just fold up the company?" And he said, "Because the people that didn't get paid, the vendors who had been to our weddings and our christenings and our baptisms, they were small businesses. If I didn't pay one guy $200,000 that I owed him, he would have gone bankrupt. If I didn't pay another guy $150,000 that I owed him, he would have gone bankrupt. He said there would have been about 15 of those vendors whose families would have been destroyed because I decided to go bankrupt to protect my family. He said I couldn't do it. So he paid all the vendors off, paid every vendor every penny that he had. And then for about a year and a half, he fought with the insurance company. The new insurance company, he actually called his insurance broker and found out that he wasn't the agent for the company, hadn't been the agent for 18 months. So the new insurance company, they fought him tooth and nail, and they felt that if they could drag this out, that he'd run out of money, and that's exactly what happened. My dad ended up basically being insolvent, and he was walking. He told this story to me when we were older, and it's a very emotional story. And he said, I was literally left the courthouse in Brooklyn, was walking over the Brooklyn Bridge, and I don't know if you know the Brooklyn Bridge, but it's kind of big, and there's a lot of infrastructure there. And my father was trying to figure out a way to get to the end so he could jump off the bridge. He said, I just wanted to end it all. I felt about an inch high. My confidence was shot. I had failed my family. And I just thought to myself, what good am I? And he started trying to work his way through the Brooklyn Bridge, the cables and everything, to get to the end. And he got close, and he started looking over the bridge, and he saw these white caps, in the mm-hmm. Hudson River. And he said, in every one of those white caps, I saw a picture of one of my kids. So I backed up. I got back on the bridge. I walked to the Staten Island Ferry, which was about 2 miles away, and I got back to work. So he had 11 in our family. If my dad had jumped off that bridge and killed himself, we would have been
11 siblings total.
We had eight brothers and sisters. My mom and dad and my Aunt Peg. They all were dependent on my dad.
Wow.
And so I was shocked when he told me that. He reminded me of that George Bailey, It's a Wonderful Life. My dad ended up recovering. He retired a millionaire, which took about 20 years, but he got there. Because these million-dollar habits, these rich habits, they don't leave just because your money leaves. They stay with you forever. So my dad, through his relationships, he built everything back up. Not the same business, but he made enough money where he retired a millionaire.
Tom Corley is my guest, and he's talking about a lot of the very, very popular and habits, must-have habits, to become a millionaire or wealthy. And one of the things that you mentioned is that how they are so attuned to relationships and networking.
Yeah, so I like to say that relationships are the currency of the wealthy. They are literally more important than money. They open up doors, and they don't just open up doors to Mark and to Tom Corley. They open up doors to Mark's children, to Tom Corley's children. These doors might be internships at Google, might be somebody that they know at a college at Notre Dame so they can get in, or Boston College, or any of the colleges that you're trying to get your kids into.
And you have to even think digitally nowadays. Those doors are even connected to the LinkedIn pages, et cetera, whatever platform or server you want to consider.
Yeah, it's like a centipede when you know one person now. Maybe 20 years ago or 15 years ago, if you knew one person, they knew maybe 10 people that could help you. Now, if you know one person.
And Kevin Bacon.
That's right. For example, I have about 50,000 people that follow me in different social medias, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook.
And your wife's okay with that?
And my wife's okay with that, yeah. None of them are attracted to me, so she's okay with that. I can reach out to 50,000 of these people
at any time
and say, hey, I need some help. Like I need help with the Ashley Lauren Foundation raising some money for something. Next thing I know, we've got $5,000 pouring in for our cause. So they can open up doors now more than ever. The internet is the greatest relationship building tool around.
Well, case in point, you are a self-published author. And this book is published in how many different countries right now available and in languages?
It's probably in a dozen countries right now.
Dozen countries and how many languages?
Chinese, Korean, South Korean, whatever that is, Korean. It's in India. It's English and Australia.
So you're over at five countries and counting.
Yeah.
So this is proof in the pudding that you had a client who came in your office, crestfallen, didn't know what to do, was directionless, and then that spawned that idea. You had the epiphany. You started doing this research, comparing the rich and the far from rich, and here you are 7 years later, international speaker. You're four books down the road now.
Mm-hmm.
You're a prime example of what can happen when you are keeping your nose to the grindstone.
Yeah. So one of the things that I found in my research is, and it's one of the major rich habits, is wealthy self-made millionaires pursue their own dreams. They pursue them when they're poor or stuck in the middle class. So that's what I did. I pursued a dream. I said, let me get this information out. I wrote a book. I had 143 literary agents turned me down.
143.
About 120.
What was the basis overall? It's been done. What was the reason?
They just weren't interested. You get these. So just so you know, when you send out a query letter to a literary mm-hmm. agent or a publisher, when they turn you down, it's never a personalized letter.
No,
it's a little slip of paper that some intern has to slip into an envelope and send out to everybody that gets rejected. So there's no personal reason why they just don't know you. They don't care about you.
You're an unknown entity.
And they don't actually have their finger on the pulse. Yeah. I hate to say it. Literary agents and publishers, just look at what Amazon is doing. Eating their lunch because they can't even figure it out themselves in their own industry.
But I'm happy to report, though, the industry is actually not dissolving as fast and as rapidly as once predicted 10 years ago.
Right. It's not. And actually, these publishers are starting to realize that the best source of the best literature out there right now is self-published books. So they're the ones that really have their finger on the pulse are reaching out to people like me. China South is the number six largest publisher in the world. Even though nobody in the U.S. Has reached out to me, China South did. And now they're publishing two of my books. And they gave me a significant advance. They're going with 15,000 books, which is huge. And I've got two publishers in South Korea doing the same thing. So my books have really hit a nerve. I've got close to 100,000 books sold, self-published books sold. Now they're all being published all over the world through traditional publishers.
So when your book comes out, what do you think the Rio Kawasaki's and the Susie Ormans of the world think about this?
Well,
and
I know
how does your book differentiate?
So what makes my book unique and everything that's in it unique is all these people talk about success traits, what to do. They don't tell you, hey, this is what poor people are doing and this is what you need to avoid. And like I mentioned, it's great to know what to do, but that only gets you halfway down the field. You have to know what not to do. Actually, I think knowing what not to do is far more important than knowing what
to
do.
Sure.
Because everybody, Mark, knows what to do. But they don't necessarily know that, hey, you shouldn't speak your mind. My Aunt Peg taught me that you should speak your mind. I didn't know that. That's a poverty habit. Why is it a poverty habit? Because you can damage a relationship that you've built up over the last 10, 15 years. And you decide, hey, you know what? I speak my mind. I can say whatever is on my mind because I'm Tom Corley. And that's the habit that I was picked up on as a kid. And you find out that it destroys a relationship that could have helped you down the road. So that's one of the I didn't know that was one thing. How about the have your emotions on an even keel? Instead of getting really pumped up or really down, just stay on an even keel. Mm. Don't let anything bother you. Don't let anybody know you're sweating. Don't let anybody know you're giddy, because you want them to think this is just normal for me.
Sure.
Success
you're
is normal.
As very reliable, in control, which is everything.
Trustworthy. Mm-hmm. People want to do business with people they like, and they don't want to do business with people who they perceive as being volatile.
And one thing I found very, very interesting, which, you know, the more I thought about it, when you read and think about these most powerful people, they start their days quite early, and a lot of them are OCDs on many and type A's, big time, which is a great characteristic to have because it drives and fuels people for success. So getting up early to read two or three papers, either digitally or hard copies, and working out fuels them knowledge-wise and to spark their acumen and drive and initiative.
Yeah, well, so when I found that out, that almost 50% of the self-made millionaires in my study got up 3 hours or more before they actually began their workday, I immediately adopted that rich habit. So now I get up at between 4:30 and 4:45 in the morning, and I do all these rich habits. I have my writing, my reading, my technical reading, my reading to learn. And then I also have my, you know, some of the social media relationship building rich habits. So I've got 3 hours in the morning. Yeah, and you also know that I go to the gym all the time. I run every day. So why is exercise so important? I just wrote a piece on this on my website that self-made. There's a reason why self-made millionaires exercise aerobically. And the reason is there's science behind it. So when you exercise aerobically, you're feeding your brain with oxygen. That oxygen is used by the cells. It feeds. It filters into the brain, the cell membrane. The mitochondria take that oxygen, combine it with glucose primarily, and then rip the glucose apart using oxygen as a catalyst, as a way of, like on the Serengeti, they're ripping the carcass mm-hmm. apart, and then these free radicals, which are really just pieces of the glucose that fly off the free electrons. Oxygen also soaks them up as a sponge. So when you exercise aerobically, not only are you feeding your brain with more oxygen so that your mitochondria can be more efficient in processing glucose, you're also enabling it to clean the cells better. So you have healthier cells, which means healthier brain cells. It also boosts the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is like a miracle grow for the brain. So that BDNF not only helps preserve brain cells, keeping them healthy, it helps grow new ones.
Absolutely. Besides all the obvious information that's come out lately about staving off all Alzheimer's, dementia conditions, mm-hmm. everything.
Yeah, there's so much science that's coming out, and I keep up with all these studies. And what I'm finding out is now I know why the rich people exercise aerobically every day.
So they can live long enough to enjoy their money?
So that they can be, because aerobic exercise increases your IQ. It increases the number of brain cells that you have. It gives you 20% more energy because when you exercise, particularly more than 45 minutes of aerobic, you start the body starts using ketones as energy instead of glucose.
I'm a major proponent of this. I preach to people, oh, I don't have enough time. I'm too tired. I'm like, listen, you got to make the time, and you will have a boundless amount of energy if you just give yourself the allotment that you need.
Yeah, so we all heard that. You know, you exercise because it gives you more energy. Sounds counterintuitive, but let me give you the science behind it. So when you exercise aerobically, and it really has to be about 45 minutes or more a day aerobically.
Not 7 days a week, though.
Well, as many days as you want, but mm-hmm. every day that you do it, you're going to force your body to use ketones as a source of energy. And those ketones, when they're converted inside the cell by the mitochondria into ATP, which is the ultimate fuel source of the body, ketones are converted into 20% more ATP. So not only do we have more energy within each cell, that means we also have the more energy in our bodies and in our thinking, because the cells are just, you know, a microcosm of what's going on in the whole body. So that's how you get more energy.
I love it. I didn't think we were going to be going there today, Tom. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Tom is the author, speaker, CPA, CFP, and president of a top New Jersey financial firm. His first book, Rich Habits, The Daily Success Habits of Wealthy Individuals, came out a few years ago, sold in multiple countries, multiple languages. And in one of your books and also in an article you wrote, a great article in Success Magazine, you write about the four types of luck. Talk about those, please.
Yeah, so I want to preface this by saying you'll never be successful, wealthy, and successful unless you have luck. That's just the way it is. But what poor people think is you need random luck, random good luck. Well, I uncovered in my research that there's actually four types of luck. There's random good luck and random...
Is this luck that you devise yourself?
Well, random good luck and random bad luck are fairly democratic.
Yes,
they affect rich people and poor people.
The nature of life.
Just the way it is. But then there's opportunity luck and detrimental luck. Opportunity luck is the type of luck that wealthy people create. They create it a number of ways by having these good, rich habits. They create it by being persistent, by pursuing a dream.
Just like anybody. Like, you're here today doing interviews. Somebody hears this, they call you up, and they want to make a movie after you.
It's happened. I got a call from a bulk of somebody in the UK.
Yeah.
They wanted to buy 15,000 of my books in a bulk purchase off of a radio program that I did.
Fantastic.
So
that's an example of good opportunity luck.
I created my own opportunity for luck to occur. That's what, if you think about like an apple tree, right? When rich people, when these people that have these rich habits, they're like planting an apple tree. Those habits are like apple seeds. And they nurture them and they grow and the apple tree grows and eventually it bears fruit and the fruit is opportunity luck. Well, it's the same thing with detrimental luck. The poor people, they have these poor habits. They're like apple seeds. They plant them and they nurture them by, you know, having those habits every day and by living those habits every day. And the habit and that tree grows, that apple tree grows, and it does bear fruit. And when it bears fruit, it's a heart attack, it's a job loss, it's bankruptcy, it's any number of things that divorce. Any number of bad things that go wrong,
sure.
that are the byproduct of having a lifetime of bad habits that all of a sudden come crashing down like an avalanche. So, and inversely, when you have the rich habits, it's like an avalanche. It's an avalanche of success, however. When you do all of these things, you know, you ever hear the saying, yeah, it took me 20 years to become an overnight millionaire.
Absolutely.
Well, that's the avalanche of success. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you're building up all of these credits in your investment in yourself. And then the payoff day happens, and it's like hitting the lottery.
Well, we know it's also called serendipity, but I mean, it's the right place, right time, but you have to have the experience, you have to have the gumption, you have to have the tenacity and the resiliency.
Yeah, so let me give
in
you,
any field.
Talk about timing.
Especially radio.
and serendipity. So let's talk a little bit about radio. So I did, Yahoo came in to my office with five people. They did a TV interview on me. And they released the interview, and I remember when the producer was walking out, I said, you know, how many hits do you think I'll get on this interview? And she said, well, probably 50,000. We've never had more than 400,000 hits. So I was a little down on that, but they released the interview about a month later.
Hey, exposure is exposure.
Whatever. You know, I'll take what I can get. So they released the interview. It was July 16th, 2013. In 24 hours, it had over 2.2 million hits.
Wow.
And one of the people that that clicked on that interview was Dave Ramsey. Dave Ramsey's at the time was the third largest radio host in the United States. And talk about serendipity. He said, I come home that night after the Yahoo interview was released. And it was about 9 o'clock. I'd just coming back from a client. My wife said, hey, some guy named Dave Ramsey's been trying to reach you. So I said, Dave Ramsey. I'm trying to think of a client named Dave Ramsey. I said, I don't have any clients named Dave Ramsey. She said, no, he's some radio host. I said, Dave Ramsey, the radio?
The Dave Ramsey, the yeah.
So I called, I actually spoke to his daughter, Rachel, that night. And we were on the radio that Friday. I was only supposed to be on for a segment, which is 5 minutes. I was on for 30 minutes. And I had people that nearly crashed their car listening to Dave Ramsey when I came on, who knew me. They said, I couldn't believe I was listening to Tom Corley. I sold probably 12,000 books in about a week off of that radio program. And it caught the eye of CBS. CBS then interviewed me. They went out to about 15 million households in the United States and Canada. So this is, you talk about pursuing something, a rich habit, your dream. You just don't know where it's going to take you, but these rich habits take you to places you would never believe.
Well, that overnight success happened in 2010 when you started the idea, the epiphany of doing all this, the interviews of 5 years worth of work, the production of the book, obviously doing all the PR, and obviously it's between the covers. What's the material that hits home for people? Do you think this book is more effective for one class versus the other?
Yeah, that's such a good question, because when I thought about writing Rich Habits, I was thinking about it from the poor person standpoint. I hated rich people, to be honest with you, almost my whole life. And so I thought, I'm going to help poor people.
Why do you hate rich people? Did you or do you?
I just came to the conclusion that rich people were rich because of random good luck. What my father had gone through, I thought, here's a guy that built up an incredible business.
Sweat equity.
And bad luck just took him down. So I guess rich people are rich because of just good luck. That's what was in my head. So I hated rich people because we were poor most of our lives, to be honest with you. And so I was like, well, you know, I'm going to write this book for poor people. And the irony is, like 99% of the people that buy my book are either upper middle class or rich people. The poor people could care less about my book, Rich Habits.
Why so?
Because I think they feel hopeless. I think they feel like they're
part of the system, a cog in the system.
They feel they're entitled to their poverty because of society. There's a mindset that it's not their fault, that society's holding them down, that they have no control over things.
To a certain degree, I believe some of that is correct.
Yeah, but
very minimal.
Keep in mind, Mark, that 41% of the wealthy in my study were poor.
Yeah.
Dirt poor. So it can't.
Okay.
Being poor, being born poor, is actually one of the prerequisites to becoming wealthy, because most people who become wealthy are poor, 41% in my study. So you can't use your poverty as a crutch and say, well, the reason I'm poor is because I was born poor. It just doesn't work that way.
Let me just interject, give you a slight little example, and I don't want to belabor the point. But, for example, I just read the other day that apparently in the former administration, Obama, there's something, I don't know what it was called, but basically to make online tax paying free and available, like a lot of other countries do. So basically they know how much you make. They know all your personal information. So all you have to do is log on and everything's populated. Maybe you plug in a few other things. Boom, done, free. Mm-hmm. But guess who has problems with that? TurboTax. What's the other? H&R Block. All these other companies have quashed this big time. There's only about, 2% of people that even know about it and or take part of it. And more importantly, it's made so complex and convoluted that they give up, because obviously they can tell how long someone's been on a page. So things like that, you know, do exist. But certainly I totally agree with you that it's more fuel for the fire to change your circumstance of life, to get educated, or just to go to that technical school, or to meet the right people through networking, to get out of that neighborhood, whether it's an urban environment, to live a better life, to become a better father or a better mother, to have kids that you can financially prepare for life. And the list goes on, and I agree with you there.
Yeah, so you mentioned a bunch of rich habits just in that, you know,
soliloquy.
That soliloquy of yours. I want to highlight a few of them. So the one of the things you said, reading. Well, in my research, 88% of the self-made millionaires read 30 minutes or more for self-education every single day.
Makes complete sense.
It makes sense. And the other thing is they documented what they learned. And this is all part of what's now becoming a big deal called deliberate practice. They're finding out that a lot of wealthy, successful, high performers are who they are because of deliberate practice. Deliberate practice requires that you have habits that you perform every single day. This is what sets wealthy people apart from poor people. Wealthy people deliberately practice some of these habits every day.
And that's something that's obtainable, because we're not talking about tools that are out of reach for people.
No, actually, what I found in my research, and I'm actually the example of this. I am the guinea pig, so to speak, because I was not wealthy when I finished my study. But you would consider me wealthy now, at least on paper, I'm wealthy. I have now 10 streams of income, whereas when I started my research, I had one, the CPA business. Now I have 10. And my income has doubled since I finished my research. I've adopted these rich habits myself as the guinea pig. And I went from 212 pounds, and I'm down. I weighed myself yesterday. It was 181 pounds. And so my health has improved dramatically. I no longer get bronchitis because of the exercise that I do. I used to get it every year. And so there's a lot of things that have changed in my life as a result of these rich habits. But here's the magic secret I want to share with everybody. I've only adopted two or three of these habits. There's 334 of them. I adopted two or three of them. And I've doubled my income. I've created nine more sources of income. I've reduced my weight by about 30-something pounds. I can run a half marathon tomorrow. If you ask me to run a half marathon tomorrow, I could run it. I could lift 250 pounds on the bench. All of these things. I have relationships with people in the media that I could pick up the phone and I could say, hey, my book's coming out. Can we do a series of interviews? And they say, absolutely.
And so, it doesn't hurt that you've been on stage with Sir Richard Branson.
That's right. That was an interesting one. So at the Titan Summit, I was this is serendipity. This is the opportunity luck manifesting itself. So I got interviewed by Success Magazine. I was profiled, and they did I was in their CD. They have a CD that, at the time that came with the magazine. So Robin Sharma, who is one of the – he's sold probably 15 million books. He's one of the top leaders in the world, leadership experts in the world. He runs this thing called the Titan Summit, and he was driving in his car listening to the Success CD and listening to Tom Corley. He literally called me from his car in Toronto and said, I want you to be at my next Titan Summit as one of our speakers. And so I went there and I met Richard Branson, Dr. Daniel Amen, who is really getting – everybody should know who Dr. Daniel Amen is. And he's incredible with the spectral analysis of the brain. He's really a smart guy. And I met Dr. Greg Wells, who's becoming very big. And the interesting thing is that Robin put me up right after Richard Branson. So Richard Branson got up there and did his thing, and then I had to follow. Imagine that. You have to follow Richard Branson. I was petrified when I found out. I begged him to switch it off to somebody else and let me do, you know, be behind Branson. And he said, nope, you're stuck. And so the good news is Richard Branson isn't a very good speaker. And after he got done, he has a lot of great traits, but speaking isn't one of them.
Well, he's got ADHD, a few issues. Obviously,
he's all over the map.
Yeah,
and
succeeds.
And when he was done with his speech, I was ready to jump on stage because I am a good speaker. I've been doing this for years. I know what I'm talking about, and I have a structured format that I'm following.
Mm-hmm,
made everybody came up to me afterwards and said that was one of the best speeches that we had all week long. And my point is not to brag, but to point out that this opportunity, good luck, only manifests itself when you adopt some of these rich habits and pursue some important goals and dreams in your life, which the rich habits help you do.
And before I let you go, I want to talk about your second book real quick, Rich Kids, How to Raise Our Children to Be Happy and Successful in Life. And maybe the ... should be, and living on their own, right?
Yeah, not in your basement.
Yeah, exactly. Rich Habits, Poor Habits, and am I missing one?
Change Your Habits, Change Your Life. That one is actually my second biggest selling book. It's sold about 30, 40,000 copies, and it's being published as we speak in China.
Tom Corley, what's your website?
Richhabits.net.
Richhabits.net. Tom Coy, thank you so much for your time, insight. And it's about luck, but it's about creating that luck, that opportunity. And obviously, we didn't touch on all the obvious things that everyone's heard about for years and years. Get all the maximum you can in your 401k, 5%, you spend on a car, no more than that, buy versus lease, all that stuff. But all the things you shouldn't do are in your book.
That's exactly right. Thanks
Yankee
for having
fan?
Me on.
Yankee fan?
I am now. Today.
Giants fan?
I am a New York fan.
Okay, all right. My name is Mark Farrell. Go Yankees. And Giants, hey, 0-5. Jets take on, I don't know why this is becoming a sports program, but it's a big sports time right now. A shout out to the Jets taking on New England this weekend. My name is Mark Farrell. The founder of the Progressive Radio Network is next. Gary Noe, have a great day.